Master in Modern History at Goldsmiths, University of London, author, as we probably all know, of The Children's War, Britain 1914 to 1918. I've been told to keep the intro short, so I won't sing her praises over much, but I'm very excited to be welcoming her and to listening to her keynote on Esprit Indeed, Children's Literature and the Imagination in First World War Britain. Over to you, Rosie.
Thank you very much, Jane. And thank you, Katrina and Andy, for inviting me here today. Can I just give it a little try to make sure? Yeah, okay. One of the most enduring paradigms of the First World War has been the supposed division between those who fought and those who did not. One's experience, we are told, was defined by whether or not you saw action. This separated the soldier from the civilian and the war generation from those that came after. More recently, however, this paradigm has been challenged by historians who point to the enduring connections between battlefront and home front, and the continuities of experience between soldier and civilian. The two worlds were not always so separate, either physically or mentally, as each side employed strategies for coping which relied on each other for support. Husbands and wives, mothers and sons, lovers and friends maintained their relationships and connections with home through a variety of material, emotional, and imaginative means. And here I would like to argue that we should include children too in our analysis of the connections between home and family, between home and front line. As we reflect on the centenary of the First World War and think here today about how we might help future learners engage with the difficult histories of war and Holocaust, I hope it might be useful to consider how children during 1914-18 came to understand the challenging times they were living through. Children did not fight in the First World War, and so their understanding of the conflict was shaped by other experiences. Children's ability to comprehend the war and relate to those who saw conflict, like the fathers and brothers they were separated from, was in part dependent on their ability to empathise with that experience. Empathy required imagination, and this paper will explore how imaginative connections were made by both children and their fathers as each attempted to maintain their relationships with each other and reconcile themselves to the reality of their wartime experience. My research in general focuses on the experience of British children during the First World War. I'm interested in the effects of war on children's lives, as well as how they came to understand it. I've looked at children's education and family life, at their involvement in youth groups, and their participation in the home front war effort. But as part of that research, I've also been thinking about the ways children engaged with the war imaginatively, how they explored it through the games they played and in the fiction that they read, and it is that that I'm going to talk about today. In their fiction, children were offered a particular version of the war, one that presented Britain's cause as just and the enemy clear. This fiction offered children examples of the roles they could play, both now and in the future, and an idea of the sorts of characteristics needed by a nation at war. The themes of wartime fiction reflect the concerns and anxieties of contemporary society. These children's books and stories offer us insight into the moulding of a wartime generation and their understanding of conflict. But I would also like to suggest that children's imaginative engagement with the war extended beyond the commercial fiction produced for them. In my reading of the letters sent between children and their soldier fathers during the war, I found traces of the ways in which these correspondents relied on shared imaginative tropes to bridge the distance between them in both distance and experience. Fathers invented stories of their wartime selves in which they could appear quite safely for their children, and children in turn imagined their fathers in surroundings they were comfortable with. These imaginative connections allowed families to continue to be together in spirit if not in body, and offer us an insight into the imaginative landscape of wartime families. So to begin, let's think about the Edwardian child. Increasing prosperity, the introduction of compulsory schooling, and restrictions placed on the employment of children meant that more and more families in the late Victorian and Edwardian periods found that they had children at home and money to spend on them. Children's toys and publishing were major industries, and the products and stories produced reflected contemporary preoccupations. During the period of imperial expansion during the 19th century, therefore, there had been an increase in the production and consumption of toy soldiers and an explosion in juvenile fiction heavily associated with imperial adventure. Boys' juvenile literature from this period was heavily imbued with the ethos of manliness, courage, and patriotism modelled on the public school tradition. That tradition was disseminated to grammar school boys and the working classes through the cheaper boys' magazines of the day. Magazines like the Boy's Own Paper, The Captain were relatively inexpensive and enjoyed a wide circulation amongst the newly literate population. In the years before the First World War, these papers were filled with stories that highlighted the need for a stronger army to repel invaders. Frequent stories about German attempts to invade Britain appeared in the first decades of the 20th century in papers like The Boy's Friend, The Boy's Herald, Marvel, Gem, and Magnet. The attempts were always unsuccessful, scuppered on various occasions by Boy Scouts, schoolboys, and regular fictional heroes like Sexton Blake. Evelyn Waugh, growing up in Hampstead during this time, for example, remembers the strength of this theme during his childhood and the influence it had on him and his friends. The children formed a gang known as the Pistol Troop and built a camp stocked up with provisions. He says, "We had some scuffles with Roman bands who attempted to enter our fort, whom we repelled with fists, clay balls, and sticks. But we were not provocative. We were reserving our strength for the Prussian Guard." It's easy to understand, therefore, why some historians have argued that these tales of imperial adventure and potential invasion helped pave the way for the enthusiastic response to war in Britain in 1914. While we need to think carefully about the readership of these stories and the demographic profile of the recruits in the early months of the war, it is interesting to note the links between popular understandings of warfare and attitudes towards the conflict in its early stages. Boys' fiction during the war itself continued in much the same way, with a focus on the justification of Britain's participation and the superiority of her forces. Transposing the setting from the imperial colony to the Western Front, the stories were packed with adventure and intrigue for the hero from the start. War stories, like their imperial predecessors, were formulaic. Our young hero was always amongst the first to volunteer, has numerous close scrapes along the way, and often manages to transfer regularly between the different branches of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, allowing him a full range of opportunities for heroism. British soldiers are always gallant, brave, strong, and resilient, their German counterparts sneaky, underhand, and cowardly. As in real life, many of the lead characters are young boys who've lied about their age in order to enlist, desperate to get out to France before the war is over, and they miss their chance. The fighting described in these books predictably bore little or no resemblance to the real thing. Authors and the public alike had very little opportunity for learning about trench conditions other than from newspapers or from returning soldiers. Newspapers, subject to censorship, and keen to sustain morale at home, did not dwell on the uncomfortable surroundings of the troops abroad. Returning troops were often reluctant to discuss their experience with family and friends, in part to spare them the horrors that they were experiencing, but also to protect themselves from having to discuss at length things they would rather forget for their short time on leave. Equally, the reality of the grim stalemate on the Western Front provided little inspiration for exciting adventure fiction. For the books to sell and for their message to be successful, it was no good having your hero sitting in a hole in the ground, up to his knees in mud, for weeks at a time. Set on the battlefields of Vimy, Messines, and Ypres, where some of the most horrifying battles of the war actually took place, Frederick Sadier Brereton's Under Haig in Flanders illustrates the artistic license authors employed when writing. At one stage, our hero has, as usual, volunteered to undertake a dangerous raid into enemy territory. A spree indeed, it was a desperate and most adventurous undertaking. Not that Roger or Bill or the sergeant thought of it in that way. They ate their supper with gusto, sat chatting a while, and turned in to sleep like children. Then, an hour before dawn, a sentry wakened them, and, having drunk a steaming cup of cocoa apiece, for comforts are not by any means non-existent in the trenches, the three made ready for the journey across no man's land into the country of the enemy. We know from soldiers' testimony that, in fact, men often found waiting to take part in dangerous action one of the most difficult things to do. The anticipation and fear prevented men from sleeping, or being able to eat, and instead forced them to confront the dangers they were facing. In the 5 months of 1916 that the British fought on Somme, roughly 500,000 British troops were killed and little ground was won. According to Brereton, however, the battle went well, with the men fighting bravely and skillfully. Perhaps feeling unable to claim total success, he explains, "It was not the capture of ground we sought, nor the destruction of dugouts and defences. It was to drive a blow home to the heart of the enemy, to destroy the soldiers of the Kaiser, to break the strength of the German invader. That we went far to achieve that object, there is no doubt." The comforts of Brereton's war at the front included frizzling bacon not to be beaten anywhere, bread that might have graced the table of the Ritz Hotel, and jam that would be the envy of any housewife. As well as inspiring readers with an exciting and positive image of life in the army, children's authors were also keen to present the enemy as one worth fighting. If morale was to be sustained at home, government propagandists and pro-war journalists and writers knew that a sustained negative perception of the Germans needed to be maintained amongst the British public. Children's authors were always ready to exploit the negative attributes of their German characters, and German troops were depicted as both unsportsmanlike and cowardly. The Germans were derided as fighting men, and their tactics were regarded as underhand. In that same book in Underhaven, Flanders, sniping, a tactic employed by both armies, is discussed by a sergeant in the trenches who claims, "It's a craze with them Fritzes. They like killing people in a dirty sort of way, they do." In addition to the negative attributes of the Germans as soldiers, the Britain of wartime fiction was overrun with German spies, many of them appearing as ordinary citizens who've been living here for years. The popularity of this theme can perhaps be understood by the fact that it gave authors the opportunity of suggesting to children a way in which they could help win the war. The fact that your next-door neighbour could be a German spy meant that children could take part in some amateur sleuthing of their own. The spies, it appears, were not hard to spot, and they are usually suspected because of some small but obviously un-British trait, like a grumpy nature or a cruel smile. Foiling a domestic spy ring was a particularly popular theme for girls' wartime fiction, with the obvious advantage that it allowed girls the opportunity of seeing some action on the home front. Brenda Gervin's eponymous heroine in Munition Mary single-handedly foils a German spy ring attempting to sabotage the newly employed female labour force in the munitions factory owned by the fierce Sir William. Sir William is so prejudiced against women working outside the home that he will apparently walk up several flights of stairs rather than get into a lift operated by a woman. Mary's colleagues initially blame the sabotage on Sir William himself, but the loyal Mary fights to prove his innocence and ultimately captures the Germans. Throughout, however, Gervin is pains to let her readers know that Mary lost none of her womanliness, despite taking up men's work. It takes all of this to win round Sir William, who eventually concedes. This girl had shown intelligence and capability, yet surely nobody could be more feminine than she was. Her tears on that awful night. Only a very feminine woman would have given way to tears as she had. Her chutney making. His grandmother had made chutney. She had all the charms of his grandmother. He had been wrong to think that when a girl did a man's work, she lost her womanliness. Generally speaking, female authors writing for girls were quick to take advantage of the changing social climate in which women were taking up the opportunities of more and varied work outside the home and for the war effort. The heroines, albeit fewer in number than their male counterparts, work on land, in the factories, and as army and ambulance drivers. Some are impatient with the slowness of social change. In A Transport Girl in France by Bessie Marchant, the heroine Gwen delivers a scathing attack on British attitudes. Gwen's working on a farm, having volunteered early in the war. She's applied for a transfer as she knows her superior driving skills could be used to free another man for the front. When her request for a transfer is refused, she laments to a friend, "My dear Daisy, the war may have changed us in a few things, but in downright bedrock essentials we are just where we were, just as stodgy and stick-in-the-mud as ever. No wonder the Germans used to beat us in trade. No wonder we find them so hard to beat in warfare." Gwen eventually gets her transfer, and by the end of the tale is in France driving for a general. But Gwen's character continues to push the boundaries of traditional fiction, and our inevitable happy ending sees her literally lifting the man she loves out of a collapsing building. Girls' fiction was not remarkably groundbreaking, although it does hint at the possibility of a greater role for women in the post-war world. Women writers always presented energetic, capable, and competent heroines in their books, and while the girls may have been keen to retain their womanly charms, they did at least roll their sleeves up and get stuck in when given the chance. Literature for younger children was equally packed with war-related themes. Picture books, illustrated alphabet and counting books, all offered the very youngest an opportunity to engage with the language and imagery of warfare. So this is the army version, that's Our Soldiers and ABC for Little Britons. I don't know whether you can read those notes. I for the Indians, loyal indeed, sons of the empire who come at her need. J for their journey across the salt sea. K for Lord Kitchener, proud as you please to shake by the hand such heroes as these. There was a Navy version. There were regimental pets of the British Army colouring books. You know, there was a whole range of similar sort of titles available for much, much younger children than the fiction I've been talking about so far. Some authors believed that the facts of war should be impressed on children at a young age and suggested the nursery rhyme as the ideal vehicle for transmission. Nina MacDonald's wartime nursery rhymes contained a total of 58 popular nursery rhymes adapted to the themes of war, dealing with every aspect of war from food shortages to military training. The content of some of the poems suggests the hopes that children will learn to hate the German enemy and fight for their destruction. Perhaps one of the most gruesome is the horrible The House That Jack Built. It's just the first few stanzas. This is the house that Jack built. This is the bomb that fell on the house that Jack built. This is the Hun that dropped the bomb that fell on the house that Jack built. This is the gun that killed the Hun that dropped the bomb that fell on the house that Jack built. This is the man in navy blue that fired the gun that killed the Hun that dropped the bomb that fell on the house that Jack built. And it goes on like that. James Thirsk, who grew up near Hull during the war, remembers a picture book which held a special place in his memory of childhood. Charlotte Schaller's beautifully illustrated At War tells the story of three French siblings whose father has gone to war. Bobby and his friends use their toys to reenact the war in their playroom, while his sisters, Zazette and Jacqueline, care for the wounded toys in their hospital. Thirsk remembers being read the story by his older sister and says, "It was for us a treasure worth more than gold and remains for Jean and me one of the happiest memories of our childhood. It was, after all, the story of three children who, like us, had a father fighting at the front." This is one of my most exciting research moments, where I'd already found this book and read it and loved it and liked the pictures. And then I came across this autobiographical account of someone who actually read it as a child and described the colours, you know, the coloured illustrations exactly as they were. And I desperately just wanted to write to him and say, "Oh, I found it, they've got one at the British Library, you know, come and have a look." I think by the time I read his autobiography, he'd be dead. But it's a very beautiful book. Thirsk, who says he's not seen the book since he was a young child, remembers every detail of it, down to the colour illustrations. It's become a significant part of his memory of the war years, perhaps because he and his sister identified so strongly with the characters in the book. As a very young child, Thirsk understood little of what the war was really about. All he knew was that his father was gone and that those around him were worried for his safety. Having a book about other children whose father had also gone to the war helped the Thirsk children to cope with their father's absence. They saw that they were not alone and that other children were facing similar fears. From these examples, I hope you can see that children were presented with a very definite position of Britain in relation to the war. There was to be no confusion. Germany was at fault and had to be stopped by the British. Children's fiction glorified the war while presenting it as the natural outcome of a confrontation between the unscrupulous Germans and the moral, fair-dealing British. The formulaic stories described the conflict in simplistic language of right and wrong. Positive British characteristics were juxtaposed against negative German ones in order for all children to understand who to support and who the enemy was. The regular appearance of these themes in children's books and magazines suggests that they were popular with readers, and so their analysis offers us an insight into children's imaginative understanding of warfare. However, literature was not the only way in which children were exposed to the war or came to understand the conflict. And so we must go beyond this to think about the other ways in which children made imaginative connections to what was going on around them. In my book, Children's War, I argue that children came to understand the war through a variety of means. In addition to the fiction they read and the toys they played with, children also learned about the war at school, and some were involved with the home front war effort through their involvement in uniformed youth groups like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides. For children of serving soldiers, however, their general exposure to the war at school, youth group, or through play was compounded by the particular effect it had on their family circumstance. For some, war came as a great relief if it took an overbearing or violent father away from home. For others, the separation was a pain to be borne by the whole family, compounded by the constant worry for their safety between postcards and letters home. And it was through these letters and postcards that children and their absent male relatives strove to maintain their relationships, as short periods of leave could be few and far between. Instead, children and their fathers wrote to each other, attempting to bridge the gap between them in both distance and experience. The letters sent by children to their fathers are full of the intimate domestic details of childhood: friendships, schoolwork, friends, family, food. By taking an interest and responding with questions or comments on such news, fathers were seeking to participate in the daily lives of their children. If they couldn't be there in person to share in their children's domestic routine, fathers inquired and prompted their children for details that would allow them to imagine the world they were missing. Fathers, in turn, often wrote to their children in a way that mirrored the domestic details of life at home. Indeed, much of the day-to-day business of work in the trenches consisted of entirely domestic chores, from cleaning and equipping the trenches to the preparation and serving of meals. So it was easy for fathers to summon up a domestic image to describe to their children. And they wrote of living conditions, food, animals and friends in a way designed to give their children a way of picturing their absent father in circumstances they could relate to. The significance for men, particularly those with small children, of situating themselves in scenes their children could picture and would be comfortable with is clear from examples like this extract from a letter Arthur Stanton sent to his children, 4-year-old Peggy and 3-year-old Hugh. From, I don't know how well you can see this. From the Western Front, Stanton drew a picture of a tent and wrote to his children in North London. You see his little tent there. He wrote, "We got some pretty plants and put them round the tent to make it nice and like home. I expect the plants belonged to some girl like you, Peggy, once, but she had to leave. She had to go and leave them behind." From reading the next few letters Stanton sent to his young children, you could be forgiven for thinking that his portion of the Western Front had more in common with a farmyard or wildlife sanctuary, so full is it with bunny rabbits, which he sketches, goats, which the men feed cake to, and dogs that he befriends, than a battlefield. But the tactic works, and the children respond in letters written by their mother but signed by them, with inquiries about the animals, and a plea to bring one of the dogs home after the war is over. Very occasionally, the war makes an appearance in Stanton's letters, like the time he describes seeing a girl sheltering her brother as a shell burst nearby. Then, perhaps as an attempt to allay his children's fears, Stanton goes on to explain the helmet he wears to protect him from falling shrapnel. Trying to make links between the war he's describing and something his children might be able to understand, Stanton explains, "Years ago, before there were any guns, soldiers wore what was called armour, that is, pieces of iron over their clothes to prevent them from being hurt by swords and spears. The bravest of these soldiers were called knights, and they rode on horses. They went about the country doing all sorts of brave deeds, and generally they found a lovely princess in the end and married her. And although we don't wear armour nowadays, except the helmet I told you about, there are still lots of brave deeds that can be done, and there are princesses too, but you have to watch for them. I found one once, but perhaps I'll tell you about that another time." Stanton's only method of explaining war to his young children is to compare it to the tales of knights and princesses they might be familiar with from their own storybooks. By doing this, Stanton escapes with them into a fantasy world where he too can be a brave knight doing deeds for their princess mother. Stanton was not alone in including sketches in his letters. Many men drew pictures for their children. Sometimes these were animals or trains or flowers, things they thought their children would enjoy. Other times, the men sketched their surroundings, showing the children their uniform or sleeping arrangements. Stanton drew animals and cartoon sketches designed to amuse his children, while the poet E.G. Buckridge illustrated his journey to France for his young son, Anthony. His son, Anthony Buckridge, went on to write all the Jennings stories later, and his widow sent me really... unfortunately, I haven't got the picture to show you, but his widow contacted me when I was publishing the book to sort of tell me all about her husband's very, very strong memories of getting his father's letters when he was serving abroad, and, you know, how important those sort of little stories were in his own sense of who his father was in those years that they were apart. Besides a detailed picture of the boat, Buckridge wrote, "I suppose you're now quite the man of the house now that I'm away, even though you're only 4.5 years old. This is Daddy going over in a steamer to France. I hope you can see him. He's the important-looking gentleman in the bows. There wasn't room to draw the captain and the crew. I expect they're somewhere downstairs, don't you? This is Daddy in his new tin bonnet. He's somewhere inside." P.A. Wise, serving with the 102nd Siege Battery on the Western Front, went even further in two beautifully illustrated letters to his young daughter, Alice. In the letters, it seems Wise is trying to make light of his situation by illustrating the humorous side of life in the trenches, although some of the pictures might well have alarmed his daughter. I don't know how well you can see these, but some of them are... this one's lovely. It says, "My dear little Curlywig, I'm so pleased with the nice letters and drawings that you sent me. This sketch shows me going to bed. You see, I do not go upstairs like you, but hope to someday. Give my love to mother and kiss her for me. Write again soon with lots and lots of love and kisses from your own loving daddy." And this one, he's done lots of little cartoons. Some of them are lovely, you know, him having a bath and his candle and things, but some of the, you know, there's also lots of explosions. This one here, but I don't know if you can see body parts kind of being sent up in the stage. So I don't quite know how old Alice was or who the pictures were, how he was trying to make her feel with those pictures. But there's humour in it, and I think making light of the situation was important. By illustrating their letters, most often to quite young children, these fathers are helping to create the story of the war experience in the minds of their children. These, just like the picture books they have at home, these fathers are appearing as characters in their own life story. For children as young as Alice Wise, 4-year-old Anthony Buckridge, or the Stanton children, imagining their father in circumstances so unlike any they had ever experienced must have been almost impossible. Their fathers, realising that their children would be confused and troubled by their absence, create and illustrate a story for them. They are the hero embarking on an adventure, crossing the sea aboard a steamer and making a home for themselves in strange and exciting tunnels. The children in turn could use these illustrations, just as they did with their picture books, to become enthralled by the tale of their father's adventure. Writing to young children, fathers looked for common experiences, details of domestic life that they could share with each other. They turned to the familiar, to animals and plants and food and surroundings, in an attempt to keep up a mutual connection. But as the war went on and the gaps between the meetings lengthened, fathers had to look for some other way to forge an identification with their children. It was no longer enough to rely on shared experiences, especially when very young children perhaps could not even really remember what it was like to have a father at home at all. Instead, some fathers attempted to create a new reality for their children through their letters. These fathers became characters in a narrative of the war, pictures on a page, or heroes in a partially invented landscape. They told the children the truth about the more pleasant aspects of their surroundings, and then fictionalised the rest to produce a tale that was both positive and exciting. But for men with older children, the stories were different. Not preoccupied with the need to describe a safe war for their children, these men often wrote with more detail of the war they were experiencing, but in a language that mirrored the adventure fiction both were familiar with. Letters describing the war range in style from jokey, gung-ho references to serious descriptive passages, which show that not all men were at pains to hide the war from their children. Captain James Foulis of the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders wrote regularly to his niece Nancy. His letters are funny and brutal at the same time, suggesting that he knew his niece would share in his ghoulish delight in fighting the Germans. His letters are full of the details of army life, describing his trenches, rather a jolly trench, because there are all sorts of little houses and snug little holes and corners dug out everywhere. Although he plays down the danger he's in, he describes the way the two sides fire shells at each other day and night. The trench, he explains, is full of rats, but rather than being unpleasant, this provides the men with a great game. He says, "This morning, one of our soldiers killed a large rat with a spade. Now we have a bomb throwing machine, so we put the rat onto the machine and threw it all the way into the German trench. I wonder if they had it for breakfast." Foulis seems confident that his niece would appreciate the humour in the rat throwing incident as much as he and his men evidently did, suggesting that he remembers very well the fun children can get out of the truly disgusting. Perhaps conscious of Nancy's age, or perhaps reluctant to admit the truth to himself, Foulis describes an exciting, amusing war, much like a game his niece might enjoy. The Germs and he throw bombs at each other while making snug little homes for himself in his trench. Foulis is likening his experience to a game, much like the one I mentioned Evelyn Waugh and his friends played earlier on when they built a camp and fought neighbouring children over territory. For some fathers, the need to share what they were seeing was overwhelming and far outweighed their concerns for what their children might need to hear. In a fascinating letter that avoided the censor, Private W. Vernon, serving on the Western Front, wrote to his daughter Lucy of the Allied retreat from the Marne after the German advance in the spring of 1918. The first half of the letter is fairly predictable, dealing with weather and family matters, much like the hundreds of other letters fathers have been sending to their children. But the second half of the letter explodes after Vernon adds pages to his unsealed letter, which had already been passed by the censor. He begins by telling Lucy about where he's been and begins to talk of the retreat. He says, "The worst of all was the civilians. They had to run for their lives and leave everything they had, only just what they stood up in, and plenty we saw with a little baby in a pram and a few odd things, just what they could lay hold of. And they were on the road for days and days, sleeping on the roadside at night. It was heartbreaking to see them." After this evocative description, however, Vernon returns to the more familiar language of wartime adventure, saying, "While we were retreating, Jerry was over the top of us with his aeroplanes dropping bombs and firing his machine gun at us, and we started firing at them. We brought one down with our rifles. It was fine sport." Here we hear the echoes of adventure fiction in the fine sport of bringing down enemy aircraft. Then again, it's possible that Vernon took genuine delight in shooting down a plane. After all, he'd just spent several years living in the trenches being shot at by Germans and so felt justified in revelling in his enemy's death. Joanna Bourke has explored the often ambivalent feelings soldiers have towards their victims and stresses the link between fantasy and experience. As martial combat has become an integral part of modern imagination through literature and film, so soldiers have gone to war already excited by the possibility of killing. As we've seen, late 19th century children's literature was full of tales of imperial battles and military adventures, and so First World War soldiers had an image of warfare in mind well before they arrived on the Western Front. In describing their experiences to their children in ways reminiscent of juvenile fiction, men were casting themselves as the heroes of a story their children might enjoy. By likening their own fantasies about the war they were fighting with the ones their children read in adventure fiction, these soldiers were attempting to find a place for the war within a fantasy world both understood. Children could imagine their fathers in a tale that always had a happy ending, while fathers could reconcile their actions to themselves by locating them in the familiar language of their own childhood stories. Perhaps because they were writing to children, men like Vernon and Foulis felt freer to employ this language of fantasy. In Vernon's case, there's a stark contrast between his description of the German advance and his account of the shooting down the plane. At first, he pours his heart out to his daughter about the realities of warfare, detailing the heartbreaking sight of the civilian refugees fleeing their homes. But then he returns to the language of adventure stories when he describes his own part in killing a man. Clearly, Vernon was not insensitive to human suffering, just that he chose to set his own act of violence in a different light. Writing to their children gave men a chance to return to the themes of play and adventure that had sustained their pre-war understanding of warfare. Through their words and illustrations, men constructed a wartime identity for themselves, which they presented to their children. This creation of a soldier father who lived in holes in the ground and who saw danger but was never threatened by it allowed both children and fathers themselves to come to terms with what they were facing. Children could feel positive about their father's absence because their fathers were positive themselves. In return, fathers could be reconciled to their new role as potential killers by recalling the language of fantasy that had first brought warfare to their attention. I hope that the ideas I've shared with you today suggest some of the ways in which the First World War was understood by the children who lived through it. The ways in which the war was described to them in both their fiction and the letters sent home by serving relatives allowed children to picture a conflict of which they had no direct experience. They were encouraged to imagine the excitement and adventure of battle, the courage and bravery of soldiers, as well as the dedication and sacrifice of all, both soldiers and civilians, who worked for the war effort. This, alongside the other ways children were exposed to the themes of war at school, at home, and through their youth groups, contributed to their understanding of the conflict and allowed them to make sense of the world around them. For the children of soldiers, and to some extent those soldier fathers themselves, imaginative connections became essential for maintaining relationships and withstanding the sometimes long years of separation. While the First World War themed literature consumed by readers in the century since the First World War has continuously altered in style, tone and subject, it's continued to interest those with no first-hand experience of the conflict because of the imaginative connections it allows them to make with history. As historians, we're sometimes nervous of the idea of using our imaginations, of looking beyond the possibility of establishing definite facts. But we shouldn't be. Imagination allows us to try and empathise with the thoughts, feelings and actions of others. And it inspires us to want to know more, to look deeper, think harder and go further in exploring past stories that have yet to be told.
Thank you so much.
I have so many questions, but I will open it to the floor. Can we take questions for Rosie, please? Adrian, yes, please.
I really appreciated that. Thank you very much. I'm fascinated by the letters that you've been quoting from. And you do make one reference to the influence or failure of influence of the census. And I just wondered what you discovered or what your reactions were to the censorship issue.
I mean, that was so interesting. Yeah. So that one letter where it begins in this very, you know, I read so many of these letters, which are often very similar, and you can imagine these dads sitting there thinking, well, I've got to write to the children now, I'll just, you know, I'll say what I had for supper last night, and I'll say, well, you know, and they're quite sort of dull and worthy. And then suddenly this one opens out and he says, you know, I must just tell you this, you know, and he writes pages and pages about this, and it says then you must never tell anyone, you know, I could be court-martialed for I shouldn't be doing this, but he can't stop himself. And the other really interesting thing I found out about that letter, when I went through the process of applying for copyright permission from the descendants of that man, was that he wrote to his daughter because his wife was illiterate. And so it was actually, you know, the letters were coming to the child for her to then share with the rest of the family. And this is this man's one chance to kind of to pour out what he wants to say. So it does make you really, really think that actually what we get when we read soldiers' letters is it was always so consciously written with an eye for the fact that it was going to be read by your commanding officer. I mean, who would like that? It would completely alter what you said and how you said it, wouldn't it? If you knew your mail was going to be read, and there was so many things that they couldn't say, they knew they weren't supposed to say. So on the one hand, there's the self-censorship of not writing anything that you might not be allowed to say. But then there's also the emotional kind of self-censorship of knowing that someone you might not particularly like or particularly know is going to have a look at your, you know, heartfelt message to your loved ones at home. So, I mean, you know, there are lots and lots of very emotional and touching letters being sent home too. So it clearly didn't inhibit everybody. But certainly in some cases like that, you get a real sense that censorship played a big, big part in what people were saying.
I just add one rider to that. Mm. Anthony Buckridge, whose books I read avidly when I was about 8 or 9, yeah, actually describes in one of his school stories a child writing a letter home from his preparatory boarding school and being worried that the teacher was going to read it.
Oh, how interesting. I'll ask her and have a look for that. Yeah. Well, it's the same sort of thing, isn't it?
know, you can't speak truthfully if someone's kind of looking over your shoulder at what you're saying.
Yes.
Hi, Sarah. I have a bit more technical question. Because you mentioned children at home and children's literature and children not fighting the war, but you also mentioned children lying about their age and
yeah.
being born and enlisting. So what do you count as children?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yes, and this, and so for me, I count, and this is my, you know, when I was doing my research, these are where I drew my lines. Now, obviously, we could argue about that, and lots of people do argue about that. But for me, I treated as children any young person who was being considered a child at the time. So for example, anyone in full-time education. So that excluded young people who were in work, but who might today still be classed as children. So those under, sort of. So if you think compulsory schooling varied when it ended, depending on where you lived around the country. So it could be as young as 11 or 12 in some areas. Some places you've got slightly more with continuation schools. So I was focusing on school-age children predominantly, but I also included older children when they were involved in uniformed youth organisations. So often. Scouts and guides catered for the sort of 12 to 16, 17 age group. So it, for me, it's about young people who were being treated as children by the adults around them. So if they were in paid work, I excluded them, whereas if they were under adult supervision in the kind of educational family setting, I included them. But it's an artificial distinction, I you know, freely admit. And I didn't include boy soldiers at all. Because the data we have on how many there were, or you know, is obviously very difficult to unpick, and in many senses they were being treated as adults. Mm-hmm. You know, once they've lied about their age and they're enlisted, they are in the adult world. Sorry.
Yes.
I wonder if you thought at all about the sorts of devices that, say, soldiers in the Middle East use now, where it's much harder to insulate a child from the reality of the war, mm-hmm. even with embedded reporters and things, and they edit out the gory bits, the most gory bits. It'd be interesting to see if that will be the modern equivalent of the flowers around the tent. Is
No, I don't know. I haven't done anything about, you know, how far this, in any war, in any conflict since, communicate with their children. Actually, that's a brilliant project, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I might have to steal that idea.
It sounds like it's much harder to do that today.
Because, sorry?
With all that email
and
stuff.
Yeah.
That's all, it's much harder to do that.
Yeah, the volume of it must be phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I mean, I sort of think email and, you know, we've kind of come back to the situation of people writing to each other or texting, you know, is in the way that communities in 1418 were so reliant on the letter for their communication, you know, there was such, people wrote to each other daily or sometimes
and
several times a day, and you'd get that exchange.
Back.
It's like my daughter and how she texts her friends now, you know, this constant to-ing and fro-ing of communication. So in some ways, there's quite interesting comparisons. I wonder if you think back to mid-century when we switched to the telephone, when we've got much less of that kind of communication going on. So it would be a really good project to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Any questions?
Yeah, I've got one. How far have you come across evidence of children perhaps also censoring themselves? Is that something that
what they said?
You've looked into, come across?
So one of the things you find with letters between fathers and children is you get far more letters that fathers sent home than you do that children sent out, because they don't survive in the same way that the letters that sent. So men sent letters home and their families saved them and treasured them, whereas children wrote, or wives or whatever, families wrote, and the letters got lost or left behind or damaged or whatever. So the correspondence isn't very even. Lots of what you get about what the children have said, you get from the reply. So you can see what the children asked or what they talked about because of the way the fathers reply. It's not to say we don't have some. There are some collections which have both sides of the correspondence. And you get, there's a lovely family, set of family, the Butling children. There were four of them, and they wrote to their dad. I think the collection's huge. They wrote to their dad, kind of, he was away for from 1916 onwards, and there are hundreds of letters sent between the dad and the four children that really range in age. And it's completely, I think, dependent on the age of the child. So the two boys are a bit older. They're, I think, 13 and 11, at least when the correspondence starts. And they write all the time about school and how well they're doing. And, you know, with very like adult letters, you know, we hope you're in the best of health and we, you know, wish you all the best in the next great push. And, you know, very sort of grown-up, trying to sound very, very grown-up and interested in what their dads do. But then the younger children, there's a daughter, Grace, who's about seven, and she draws lots of pictures of, you know, what she's been doing at home and writes to her dad about, again, about schoolwork and how she's behaving, really, because there's this really strong sense that men are very worried about their wives and how the family's managing at home. There's letters are full of entreaties to children to behave and to be helpful and to, you know, support their mother. And so the children write that that's what they're doing all the time. You know, we've done this and we've helped with this and we're thinking of this and things like that. So not so much self-censorship, but just trying to live up to an expectation, I think, in letters.
Sure, to say the right thing.
To say the right thing, absolutely. And sometimes you get, there's the other one where this dad's writing to his children, they're quite young, not quite as young as the two that I showed you there, but a little bit, maybe 6 and 8 or something like that, I can't quite remember. And the daughter is obviously quite a good letter writer and writes regularly, but the son obviously can't, you know, is less inclined. And so every time the dad writes back, he said, you know, I've had a lovely letter from, I can't remember the daughter's, Marjorie, but I must have one from you too, Benny. You know, I do need to know what you're doing and how things are going. Please include one next time. So there's got to be lots of parenting going on, and lots of, and that dad writes to his children about school all the time, wants to know absolutely what they're doing, and sort of makes suggestions and says things like, you know, when you want to ask a question, just think first, you know, have a little think first. Do you know the answer? What might they say? How might you, you know, so he's absolutely trying to be, you know, part of their school experience, even though he's hasn't seen them for, you know, a couple of years. So they're lovely. The letters are lovely.
I've got more of an observation, but just thinking about, and I was, well, I guess the question, if you looked at sort of brothers' letters to their younger siblings, because I'm thinking about Wilfred Owen's letters to Colin, and there's that one where he writes to him, which is just like on a boy's own paper. He's clearly saying, you know, he kind of acts it out almost, because he's giving the dialogue, and it is absolutely right out of that. And Colin was reading all of that stuff because he was younger. And the way in which all of this is sort of this identity for him, and sort of being quite clear about what's happening, but also written in that particular language. And also I was thinking that the sense that when he writes to his mother, he says, I don't write too much to father because I know you're going to read this out. So the expectation that their letters will be read, as you say, with the young woman, the young girl who's reading because her mother can't, but this idea that these letters will be shared amongst the family. Yeah. So that must be part of the expectation when they're writing it, that this is also not just to one individual,
but
many.
I think that's absolutely true. And it's really, I mean, so those Butling four children, you know, the dad often writes, he doesn't write to all four children every week, he writes to one, or particularly the older boys, and says, you must share this, you know, now with everybody. Yeah. But I mean, what I searched for when I was going through all the letters in the Butling War Museum collection is specifically parents and fathers and children. Yeah. I came across the odd uncle. I didn't do brothers, that's interesting. Mm. But of course, that misses all of the parts of letter that are parts of letters sent to wives, perhaps, that are intended specifically for children. You know, so it's absolutely is that. But then you think, then that's interesting too, isn't it? Because you wonder whether those, you know, part of what I'm thinking is that in writing to their children, men have a very particular mindset. You know, this is my letter to my son or my daughter. It's not the letter I'm writing to my wife. I'm going to say something specific about my relationship with my child. So I don't know whether that would be different in letters.
But it's, I'll point you to that particular one, because I think you'd find it interesting in terms of, because Colin was sort of young, kind of almost in the teenage, but not quite, but still young. And that language change, I think, is really interesting.
Thank you.
Well,
if we stop now, we can have a comfort break and a cup of coffee before the next session. But can I please ask you to thank Rosie for an absolutely fantastic talk? Thank you.
Thank you.